Okay, you might want to get close to your radio.
My deal is we can have an honest conversation where both sides have some issues.
I love it.
I want to officially welcome you to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hello, I'm Mo Ivory, in for Roland Martin. Today on News One Now, Aaron Hernandez is sentenced to life in prison after a first-degree murder conviction. The fight for 15 is raging as workers demand better wages. Plus, lack of evidence sets a man free after he spends 30 years on death row. We'll talk to him today. And it's What the Hell Thursday. We've got some crazy stories for you today. All that and more coming up right now on News One Now. Former NFL star Aaron Hernandez is going to be spending the rest of his life in prison. The former New England Patriot tight end was convicted of killing his friend Odin Lloyd in 2013. In a rare move, the jurors spoke out after reaching the verdict. Take a listen.
It was our duty to do it. I mean, whether we're serving our company or our country, it was our responsibility to give it 100%. Everyone in here, came in here, and although we all have our personal lives and responsibilities and distractions, I think everyone focused 100% on this case from the moment we walked through the doors to the moment we left.
During the not to form an opinion until
you've seen the evidence. We follow the court's orders. Assume that the man sitting in that seat is innocent until the prosecution proves he's guilty. And that's what happened.
Wow. Joining us on the panel today are Glenda Carr. She's the co-founder of Higher Heights. Melanie Campbell, who is the convener of the Black Women's Roundtable. And Stephanie Brown James, CEO of Vestige Strategies. Welcome, ladies. So I was watching it and I saw breaking news. The verdict is about to come in. A lot of people thought because of the amount of time that it took for these jurors to, think about the verdict, something like close to 40 hours, that it was going to mean that they couldn't find beyond a reasonable doubt. We always think that when it takes a long time. But lo and behold, they came back, and on every count, they found him not guilty and, in fact, found the whole thing to be premeditated. What was your reaction to that verdict?
I mean, I think they were deliberate because it is a high-profile case. And given, the recent high-profile case where, obviously, the media wants to talk to the jury after, I think, probably as a group, they collectively say, let's, go in and do a press conference together. I wasn't shocked, watching the coverage over the last, year and a half. It was a disturbing case. And the question becomes, was the evidence, enough to convict? And they felt like it convicted.
Yeah, a lot of people, though, did not think that the evidence was going to be enough because it was so circumstantial. There was no weapon. They could not really figure out a motive. There were a lot of areas, and even when I was talking on shows about the strength of the case, a lot of people felt that there was no smoking gun, and that would be enough for there to be reasonable doubt. What do you think?
Mental health issues, obviously. Because you make $40 million a year, and you can't handle your anger. I think it says for the NFL, obviously, because they are continuously in the press, that they have to make sure that they screen these athletes and look for the signs. Now, I think if obviously he's been convicted, so he had some real anger issues that they have to address.
I think that's so interesting what you're saying. For the NFL, when he's 25 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're playing sports and you're good at what you do, he was a fourth round pick, so he wasn't, number one pick or anything like that. But how would you test, to know if someone's going to murder somebody later on? How do you test if someone's going to shoot their friend in the eye? I mean, how would you test that?
Yeah, I'm not saying necessarily you have to. I'm not saying that they would be able to predict that he's going to kill someone, but he did have some things in his background that showed he had some issues.
Right.
And so trying to figure out that out, the last thing you would think that you're going to take it to that level, but obviously there are a lot of people in jail that it gets to that level.
No, totally.
And so that's part of the NFL point is that the NFL is dealing with a lot of issues addressing violence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very sexual hard. Violence.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
domestic
year,
violence.
Totally.
Now here you have not necessarily a star athlete, but a $40 million athlete who's now been convicted of murder.
And I think definitely the onus is on, you know, these professional sports teams and corporations in general, right, to understand the mindset of the people that they have working for them and to go a little bit deeper. But is it really their job to, like, go so deep to the screening that you are going to sort of make assumptions about what somebody might do in the future or what, you know, they their actions might lead to? I mean, I think that's a hefty sort of onus to put on a corporation. But tell me what you think about the whole thing.
Well, I think here's a challenge with the Hernandez case is that he was an individual who, for most of his life, actually benefited from the benefit of the doubt. You can look back to when he was in high school. He had problems. You can look at when he was a football star in Florida. He had problems.
Because of his talent.
Exactly, but because of his talent, they kept pushing it away and pushing it away. So this is a childhood problem that became an adult problem that now has landed him in jail. And I think that there's many people along the way who passed the buck on this young man, and unfortunately, he's ended up in a position that he's in now.
Really quickly, do you think that his sort of smug attitude, I really was surprised how confident he was throughout the whole trial. He would come in, sometimes he would laugh. He always turned to his fiance to say, I love you, and all these sort of gestures that wouldn't seem as an attorney. Well, I mean, as an attorney, when you have a defendant, you're always telling them to be of the utmost courteous to the court, not to seem unlikable, not to be arrogant. And I have to wonder if that played at all a part in maybe a juror who was a little tossy on what they thought.
But that's the disconnect of, you know, his storied past, the fact that, you know, CNN did a profile, like a long profile of him last night. I'm from Connecticut, so football is very big, to show how he had such a strong relationship with his father, and literally the downward spiral from when his father died. And then, you know, forget about the, you know, the NFL and people's thoughts of where they play in that role. It's the fact that the people around him, his personal inner circle, really wasn't able to kind of provide the necessary support
that he needed. Absolutely. Well, an appeal, I'm sure, is on the way in the Aaron Hernandez murder trial. So we'll have to just watch and see what happens. Coming up, thousands take to the streets and cities nationwide to demand better wages. And after serving 30 years on death row, Anthony Ray Hinton is free, and he is here to share his story. Plus, the National Education President says No Child Left Behind Act has failed, and she's here to explain. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Mo Ivory or on our News One Facebook page. It's 7 after the hour. Stay with us and we will be right back.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number 2, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
More money was the rallying cry yesterday as protesters nationwide demanded $15 an hour minimum wage in a movement labeled hashtag Black Workers Matter and hashtag Fight for 15. Recent reports say the income gap has become the widest it's been in 30 years. Now listen to this. On average, CEOs make $300 for every dollar that the average worker makes. Still on the panel are Glenda Carr, co-founder of Higher Heights, Melanie Campbell, convener of the Black Women's Roundtable, and Stephanie Brown-James, CEO of Vestige Strategies. All right, let's talk about this whole movement and the fight for 15 and just, you know, at what point will employers understand that people need to earn a livable wage, that you cannot make it on $7 an hour? And still, there has been no move to federally change the minimum wage. States by states can do that. Private employers can, you know, decide to change, like many have. But when will we get the backing of Congress to go ahead and say, you know what, people actually need to be able to pay their rent, feed their families, buy clothes, and have normal activities in their lives?
I think it's a misconception that we have as if low-wage workers are young workers. No, these are adults who are taking care of families. Yeah. Many of them are working 3 jobs just to be able to pay the bills. And, you know, one thing that we've seen, you know, this effort really started in 2012, and we've seen through constant protest and agitation by these low-wage workers that there are some companies who are coming around. Currently, over 8 million people have benefited from their wages being increased. Many of them are workers at Walmart or McDonald's, and And what I think we need to see a move in Congress is for these corporations who finally had the light come on to go to Congress and say, look, because we've increased the wages of our employees, this is how our company has benefited. And I think you're going to need that backing from corporate America, along with the constant pressure being put on these low-wage workers to really make that difference.
Mm-hmm. I think the other part of it, too, is people say, well, what does that mean? You know, if you're making $7.25 an hour, you're making $15,000 a year to feed your family.
Yes.
The poverty rate is $23,000 a year. Mm-hmm. If you raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, you're talking about $31,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So that you ask the question, how can you, which you made that point, to feed your families, take care of, to be that citizen everyone wants us all to be, and but yet we're not investing in our own country to make sure people have a livable wage. So that it seems like it's a lot, but at the end of the day, what is that to be able to take care of your families? And so part of why you're seeing the victories really are on a state level, and sometimes the states have to lead the federal congressional leadership.
Sure.
And so the fight we are going into 2016, as Glenda and Stephanie, we all know, and this the issue of income inequality is real. We just commemorated, I say, not celebrated, Equal Pay Day, because we're not there yet.
Yep.
And so the reality of what that means for Black women, which is, you know, my primary focus and many of our primary focus, it really means a lot, that because most of us are heads of household taking care of our families.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, Melanie exactly is right. We're in a season where we're talking about the economy, and we ought to be zealous in ensuring that there's an intersection of discussing this campaign and equal pay and the notion of what equal pay is from the broader kind of white women's movement, and for us to harness our power moving into 2016. I mean, African Americans, you know, our buying power is $1 trillion, right? So we are making these companies, and having that due pressure to ensure if we are rotating the little dollar that we have, that dollar is coming back not only into our community but into our household. Black women control 85 cents to every dollar spent in our community, and that equates to over $585 billion a year. Yet and still, we're fighting for not only equal pay, but the fact that we're, you know, the largest population of low-wage workers.
Absolutely. So let's take it just down to the street level. You're having the conversation, I'm having the conversation with people, that I think the minimum wage needs to be changed to $15. And you have people that say, well, minimum wage was always meant for people that don't have an education or don't, you know, just need to get that job. It's, you know, it's the job that the teenager has in the summer. It's the job that, you know, somebody who decided that they don't want to go to school is going to have to do. Why don't they just go to school, get a better education so they can earn a higher wage? What is the answer that you give to the person that's saying that, you know, that has no idea and is not really acknowledging all of the hurdles that are in the way of just simply going to school?
Well, I'd first say hello, welcome to America, because clearly they're not in this country.
Sure, you know, absolutely.
This is, and what's interesting is so many of those low-wage workers are college graduates. So this isn't just a problem of, you know, people who decided to drop out of high school or didn't want to go to college. No, actually, the economy is such where you have a lot of people with college degrees, graduate degrees.
With no job,
who are trying to get a low-wage job. And so I just think that, you know, sometimes we can get distracted by having conversations with people who just don't get it, and I think it's great that people are focusing on those who are most affected and trying to get those who can make the difference and pushing them to take action.
They're working in jobs that, you know, fit into our ecosystem, so it's not going, oh, these are low wages jobs. These are jobs that support us being, you know, who you are, regardless of where you are in the social economics on spectrum. What happens when you can't go get your cup of coffee,
or you can't check into a hotel, or you have no waitress, or you have no waiter,
or someone
who's cleaning the room,
grandmother, home aid workers. I mean, it runs the gamut.
And I just think
Wherever you are, we are. Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
This is an amazing story, and I'm honored to be able to be here to talk about it. In 1985, Anthony Ray Hinton was convicted of two murders and sent to death row for crimes he did not commit. He was only 29 years old at the time. 30 years later and several appeals later, he was finally found innocent and released, serving one of the longest terms on death row in Alabama's history. Anthony Ray Hinton and his attorney, Brian Stevenson, join us via Skype from Montgomery, Alabama. And I just want to say welcome, welcome, welcome. Brian Stevenson is also the author of the 2014 New York Times bestseller, Just Mercy. Welcome to the both of you, and thank you so much for being here with me today. How are you? My first question, how are you?
I'm trying to adjust. I'm still having a little trouble sleeping. But other than that, I'm trying to adjust one day at a time, 1 minute at a time, 1 second at a time.
And so what were, okay, when on that day, when you knew that you were about to be free, you spent as much time in prison as you were alive when you went into prison. What did you think? What did you feel? And could you even really believe it?
No, I couldn't believe it because we had been begging for 16 years to resolve the case. The state kept refusing. The attorney general that we have now in Alabama, Luther Skrane, had promised that he would look into the case, test the bullets, but they kept putting us off, So I never did give up hope, but I knew that they didn't want to really test the bullets because the bullets wouldn't match. So when I finally got the word, I had to really hear it and didn't believe it until Mr. Stevenson told me. Some people had told me they had heard something on the radio concerning, but until he finally said, you're going to be getting out, I began to tremble. And I couldn't even really talk to him that much long after he told me I had to just go sit down before I fall down. Because 30 years is a long time for something you know you didn't do. And to hear somebody say that you're finally going to be free, it was just an amazing agonization to hear.
Well, you seem extraordinarily composed. I've read a lot about how you said that you kept a sense of humor throughout the 30 years that you were in prison, that you believed in a faith that some people can only hope to have, and that you just knew that one day, even after the passing of your mother while you were in prison, you knew one day that you would get out. How, where did that come from, that you could even cope in that way?
Well, I tell people I wasn't born with too much, but I was born with two things. I was born to a mother that loved me unconditional, and also I was born as I got a little older with the sense of humor that I don't think too many people have, and I thank God for it. I just had to bury myself into something that I knew that could get me through from day to day. And once I started laughing and talking and making other people laugh, I felt good. I wish that anyone could have seen me on the 30 years that I was there, I mean the 28 years I was there on death row, that the way I carried myself, the way I interacted with officers, other inmates, I never did think about what I was there for. I never did think about being executed because, like I said before, I didn't accept when Judge Garrett said, I sentence you to death. I believe only God can sentence me to death. Only he have the power. And so I just took my sense of humor and just focused on making somebody else's day brighter, making them feel good about themselves. And at the same time, time was just ticking away. And woke up one morning, they said, you're going to Birmingham. We got the good ruling. I still wasn't that rejoiced about it, but I wanted to. It was a step in the right direction.
Right.
And so I just kept on joking, and I felt good, but until you hear those words, you're free. In Alabama, I'm going to be honest with you, you do not count your chicken before they hatch.
Wow, wow. Attorney Stevenson, you know, I'm looking at you and I just hear you, see you nodding your head and smiling and almost filled with a joy that can only come from freeing a man. And so tell me about how you got involved in the beginning and how it led up to the April 3rd date when he was freed.
Well, it's been one of the great joys of my career to represent somebody like Mr. Hinton. He's a remarkable human being. I tell people that in the 30 years that I've represented people on death row, I've never represented anyone who has generated more goodwill, who's generated more support, who's generated more well-wishers among correctional officers than Mr. Hinton. I could go down death row and I couldn't get in there good before people had stopped me and asked me, when is he going home? When are you going to get him out? And that's the kind of person he is. And it is no exaggeration to say that wherever he went, he created a reputation for himself as someone who was just a completely compassionate person filled with dignity. And that just made the challenges and the frustrations of getting the state to do what they should have done years ago all the more challenging. I do think this case represents the critique that we have of the American criminal justice system, which is that we have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Mr. Hinton was convicted because he's poor. He didn't have the money to prove that this false match was not a basis for convicting him. It was frustrating after we got experts involved. We got the best experts in the country to look at this evidence, and they quickly concluded that the gun that they had obtained from Mr. Hinton's house could not be matched to any of this evidence. And the state just refused for 16 years. We had to keep pushing them. We filed probably hundreds of pleadings. We've written thousands of pages of motions and arguments and briefs trying to persuade people to do something really simple, which was to retest this evidence. Mm. And it was only when we were able to persuade the United States Supreme Court, really pretty much at the last moment, really, in the process that we'd been working through, to intervene, that we could finally force them to do these tests. And it was frustrating to have such clear evidence of innocence and have it ignored for so long. I just felt like these state officials felt better risking the execution of an innocent person than risking the perception that they are somehow not tough on crime. And it was pride, it was ego, it was indifference, and
racism.
It was contempt. Racism, unquestionably. You know, black and brown people in this country are presumed dangerous and guilty. And when they're accused of a crime, that presumption of guilt makes it possible for them to be wrongly convicted. Mr. Hinton actually had a lock-solid alibi during one of these crimes. He was working in a warehouse when the crime took place, and no rational person, even with this false match, would have convicted him if they hadn't presumed him guilty. And race absolutely played a role in that presumption of guilt. I think if they had looked at Mr. Hinton like their brother or their father or their son or their uncle, their kinfolk, they would have never tolerated
the kind of
unreliable evidence.
Much of what is happening right now with the relationship between black men and the police. But let me just ask you quickly before we have to wrap up, which I hate that we have to, but what will happen next? Where is going to be the retribution?
Well, we definitely want to hold people accountable for this. Some states have automatic compensation schemes. Alabama does not. I think it's in the state of Alabama's interest. They ought to want to do whatever they can to make him whole, to compensate him. They won't do that without us pushing them, but we're going to push them. We're going to ask them to try to compensate Mr. Hinton, to try to make some remedies, not just monetary, but there are a whole host of reforms that I think should happen as a result of the miscarriage of justice that this case represents.
Absolutely. And Mr. Hinton, I just want to say thank you so much. And if there's one thing that the state of Alabama could do for you, what would that be?
End the death penalty.
Wow. That is amazing. Listen, thank you so much. Congratulations to you. I want you to get all the money, all the food, all the free time, all the relaxation that you deserve. I just want to put a big hug out there to you because I just can't imagine what you've been through, and you came out victorious just by being the man that you are. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Wow, that's quite a story, everybody. I had to keep it all together not to break out in tears for this man because I just can't imagine it. Coming up, black and Hispanic kids They are still lagging behind in school. The president of the National Education Association, Lily Estelson Garcia, tells us why. And what happens when a fake cop pulls over a real cop? You're going to find out. It's What the Hell Thursday. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Mo Ivory or at News One or on the News One Facebook page. It's 33 after the hour. Stay with us. We will be right back.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
This is a topic for every parent, every auntie and grandma, too. No child left behind. Well, of course, unless that child is Black, Hispanic, or poor. The 2002 Act is a reauthorization of the 1965 Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was originally signed to ensure all children had equal opportunities to excel in school. No Child Left Behind put a big emphasis on testing, but 77% of Americans believe increased testing has either hurt or made no difference in improving academic achievement. Here with me for more is Lily Eskelson Garcia. She is the president of the National Education Association. That's a huge job, and I welcome her. How are you?
I'm great, and maybe it was a bigger job when I had 39 sixth graders as an elementary teacher. But this issue of toxic testing throughout our country now, because in 2002 they changed that good law that was the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. I loved that law when it had a boring name. They changed it, called it No Child Left Behind. We call it No Child Left Untested.
Okay, so I mean, the original concept of No Child Left Behind was it was to put some testing mechanisms into place to measure achievement. Okay, on the face that seems fine,
exactly.
Right? When I think when I'm a parent, I have a 17-year-old, you know, she has not been able to go to public school because I just have not felt comfortable with that in my district, which happens to be Atlanta Public Schools. That's a whole nother thing we'll get to. But it really was meant to say, okay, I'm a teacher. I'm held to certain tasks. I have to teach these kids certain things they need to know, and it will come out on their test scores whether or not I am doing that. How did that go completely awry and
right.
become this, you know, this No Child Left Behind that you called No Child, you know, Untested?
Well, you know, that's the thing. We're teachers. We invented tests. I gave my kids lots of tests. I needed to know how they were doing. I needed to explain to their parents, you know, here's spelling and social studies, math, reading. Here's what I need you to do at home that's going to mesh with what I... We've always used good assessments in good ways. What changed in 2002, and by the way, it was bipartisan. They came together and they said, you know, let's find out how we can compare kids mm-hmm. in this school and that school, in this affluent kids as compared to children who live in poverty. And that was a good thing. But people who didn't actually know what they were talking about, who'd never stood in front of 39 kids the way I have, they said, and I guess we'll just all make it on a standardized test.
So all of the measurement on this one test?
All one test once a year, and we'll test all of these kids, and then we'll rank them, label their schools, tell you whether or not this third grader gets to go to fourth grade, this senior gets to graduate by whether or not they hit a cut score on a standardized test. And what we tried to say was that standardized test gives us some information, but it's very, very limited. Some kids will never feel comfortable taking a standardized test. It's why as teachers, as educators, we made sure that there were lots of ways for a kid to show us that they got it. And it was never one test given once a year that would determine whether a child was considered a failure and had to be retained or not graduate, or whether or not they were ready to move forward.
And then hence, if the teacher was a failure for the student having received that grade. And many teachers, as we know with the APS scandal at Atlanta Public Schools, right. that many teachers were so worried about not being able to get their bonuses, not being able for their school to be ranked a certain way, that they went ahead and made changes to the test just because it was all being measured on that test.
The pressure, the stress that teachers, principals, superintendents, school boards, but especially those students, the pressure those students feel at being labeled failure is by one test. And what we see that's really changed in the 12 years, and by the way, in 2002, the kindergartners are now graduating seniors.
Oh, yes.
So we have a generation of kids now
that have been under the Nocella.
under this testing dark cloud. And what we've seen because of that fear factor in our schools now, if we don't hit our cut score, then we'll be labeled failure, is they'll say to the poorer kids, you don't get
funding.
You don't get art. Yeah. You don't get recess. You don't get a sport. And for a lot of our kids, those kind of extracurricular electives were how they got scholarships. Mm. And so the things they've cut back, we've noticed they're not cutting them back in the more affluent neighborhoods. For those kids who still have to take the test, it's kind of an annoyance. But for our kids in our most vulnerable situations, they have obsessed over these tests so that they've narrowed what it means to teach and what it means to learn them.
So
and
how
that's hurt kids.
Yeah, so how will the reauthorization change that? There's a chance to change everything. What needs to get changed?
What we're seeing right now in the Senate, some good things moving. First of all, they're saying, yes, we need to know how kids are doing. I want to know how my kids are doing. But you're not going to know very much information if all you look at is that standardized test. So we've said, what about more indicators, not less, more information.
Okay.
How many kids are in an AP calculus class and how many kids don't even have access to those classes that could get you college credit in high school?
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
It's birthday shout-out time. Model Alex Weck turns 38. Singer Akon turns 42. And comedian Martin Lawrence turns 50. Wow. And NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar turns 68. On this day in history, in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln ends slavery in Washington, D.C. In fact, for D.C. Emancipation Day, there is an entire lineup of celebrations, including a free concert at 4:30 at Freedom Plaza. Performers include Eric Benet, Mesa, Dougie Fresh, and Molly Music. Also today, in 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. writes his iconic letter from the Birmingham jail, urging nonviolence to fight unjust laws. In 1973, Lela Smith Foley becomes the first African-American woman to be elected mayor when she becomes mayor of Taft, Oklahoma. And in 1987, August Wilson wins the Pulitzer Prize for his play, Fences. Today is What the Hell Thursday, and we've got some crazy stories lined up for you. Joining us today, radio show host Eddie Kane, radio personality Kitty Kaboom, and joining us on Skype from Atlanta is the host of the video show Entertainment Beatdown, Lav Love. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you on this Thursday?
Good.
Okay, so here's the first story. When you're at the gym and your favorite song comes on, what do you do? This guy heard his jam and decided to bust a move. Oh gosh!
Love it.
Oh, oh,
come
oh,
on, y'all.
Oh,
y'all
okay.
That is Marlon Wayans all day.
That
I didn't
is.
Even think
first
it was real.
All, first of all,
it looked like he was doing a parody of himself.
First of all, are those shoes or boots he got on? Did he was
but, actually? But doesn't it happen just like that though? You hear
exactly.
You hear your song no, and you start jamming.
That
and,
like that. No,
oh,
okay,
no,
I'm
no,
not
no,
doing
no,
all
no,
that.
That's
not quite everybody. Hold up.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, no, that's not me.
All right, on to the next one. 69-year-old.
And why would you be dancing while you're on a treadmill? Who does that?
No, no, he wasn't on the treadmill. That's
right, perfect. Right, he wasn't on the treadmill.
He was on the floor. He decided to get a little too jiggy with
his song. His song.
He was into it nonetheless. But right now, he's a little bruised and taking a rest.
He's a mess.
Yes,
he needs to take a rest. Sit it down.
Maybe a policeman made his treadmill. That's what happened.
Uh-oh, uh-oh.
All right, that's a whole nother story for another day. 69-year-old John Arthur Benedict was driving a Crown Victoria with a police emblem on the side when he put on his blue strobe light to pull over a white SUV. Little did he know the occupants were actually undercover real cops. The Florida man said he was having a senior moment, but cops didn't buy it and arrested him for impersonating an officer. He posted $6,500 bond on Sunday and was released. I mean, really?
I believe he pulled over some African-American men.
SUV.
They was not having it.
I just want to understand what made you think that this was going to be okay. Like, what did you gain from that? Impersonating a butcher? Okay, you get free meat. Impersonating maybe a teacher?
Free
the
meat.
Joy of teaching the children. I don't know. But a cop? What you going to get by being a cop anyway? What good
he
is
was
that?
In the Crown Victoria. Come on. Only two people drive Crown Victoria. Dope dealers and policemen. So he could have passed for either
I'm
one.
Sorry. I never aspired
once
to be
again.
A cop.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't want to be nobody's
and not
cop.
Right now.
Late life aspiration.
No one's trying to, you know, impersonate
late
a cop
life aspirations.
Right at this moment. But this is the one that really got me. I read this story. A 65-year-old German woman, Annegrette Raunick, is pregnant with quadruplets.
Ooh, when do you give it up, though? When do you stop? When is enough?
Four babies will give Raunick a total of 13 children and seven grandchildren.
I'm sorry, she wrinkled, though.
Now, this pregnancy is a result of artificial insemination. I mean, really? 65 years old, quadruplets.
Man.
She's going to come out 12 years old. the baby's going to be in middle school when the baby's born.
You already know. Come now, tell me something. Okay, when did we go to school?
But it's a disadvantage, though, because she'll be on a walker by the time they get 10 years old.
10 years. She'll be 75 when they're 10, 85 when they're 20 years old.
She might,
just so we're clear about the whole lady part situation, because I know y'all wondering, like,
how is that possible?
Here we go.
Yes. I'm just saying it happens that way.
I mean, she don't have no ocean.
Assimilation both ways. So she's just a carrier at this point. Like, that's all you're doing is walking around with somebody else from somebody else's head.
Yes, she is actually, that is very true.
Yeah.
She did not, you know, of course, we're all like, oh, but it was not through any kind of normal.
She did that a long time ago.
She wasn't like getting her. She wasn't getting her groove on.
Her 9-year-old said, Mommy, I want a little sister or brother. And she said, okay, put four in me. Let's go.
How do you explain that? How did you get to school and your mama is the only one with an AARP card?
On a walker.
Hey, look,
on
your oldest brother is 55.
Exactly.
Let's go there.
Exactly.
On a walker.
Who is this, your granddaddy? Like, no, that's my brother.
Well,
certainly she will have a lot of help from all the children she already has, right? And she also has a ton of grandchildren who will act as parents to these children. I can only imagine.
I wonder how her kids feel. I can imagine how her daughter feels.
Yes.
The daughter has to be jealous.
Imagine how the baby gonna feel.
Well, first of all, let's just put it out there. I don't care where you're from. That thing got 13 babies. She got four baby daddies. So there needs to be questions about what's going on with her.
She got some mileage. She got some mileage.
All right, all right. This is definitely What the Hell Thursday, and we have had an awesome time talking. I'm Mo Ivory, and this is News One Now. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Be right back.
Wherever you are, we are. Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
All right, we're here with What the Hell Thursday. We've been having a great time with our panel, and we're going to keep it going. So how do you kill an armadillo? Mm. Well, not by shooting it. When 54-year-old Larry McElroy fired his 9mm pistol, it ricocheted off the armadillo's back, went through a fence, a wall, and a chair, landing in, get this, his mother-in-law's back.
Can we say where the mother-in-law was seated, please?
Where was she
was a few feet away in her good old trusty house that is on wheels. So just so we're clear, these are the people that are shooting armadillo.
That was a two-for-one situation.
What kind of armadillo is this?
The armadillo.
He got mother-in-law up out of the way. I ain't mad at you, brother.
I mean, that's
he had to get his mother-in-law up out of the way.
In her trailer.
I think the armadillo is an X-Man. That's what it is.
But we're going to send our best wishes out to her.
Yeah, exactly. But the armadillo did die, I guess, by the impact alone. And so it ricocheted off and killed the mama in the trailer.
Man down.
That's what's happening in the backwoods. But moving on. That's the stories from the backwoods. So moving on overseas, China officials are cracking down on dancing grannies.
What?
Older women in Beijing. Yes, look at this. They get together in public places to dance as a form of exercise and social interaction. But some people are saying that they're too loud and the dancing is inappropriate. So what do you think?
I think
they might hook up with the lady with the 13 babies and
make some dance moves.
I mean, it doesn't look inappropriate.
Well, I think that compared to what we have to deal with, the kids getting on the metro with their radios talking about, what's up?
I think
dare you
beautiful.
To say something? I'm okay with this, all right?
Lab, what do you think about the dancing granny?
I think no child left behind, no granny left behind. Why they have to be left behind? Why should the strippers make all the money? Nana's got to, they need to.
Can you imagine throwing dollars at them out there on the plaza?
Can you imagine
trying to get their little groove on?
I think they're very sweet.
How could that be a bad thing? What is the people that are complaining?
How could that be a bad thing?
Like, you're just angry.
You're just angry, you're bitter.
Yes, absolutely.
Let the grannies dance because they didn't get invited.
That's right. Let the grannies dance. Jeez, what does it hurt? Last one.
Drop it low, Grandma.
But that's the thing about it. You don't tip grannies in money. You throw medication at them. That's it. Diabetes medicine.
Make sure you eat
blood pressure medication.
Take your high blood pressure so you can come
AARP cards.
That's terrible.
I think they definitely could find a better use of their time than to try to get the grandma. My grandmother is 103 years old. She still dances. She does all of that. And I think it's just when they get to be, you know, senior citizens, let them do whatever it is they want to do.
Maybe she could knocked up with quadruplets next
year. At 101, that baby will come out 37 years old.
So, hey.
All right, everybody. We have had a great time on What the Hell Thursday. Thank you to all my panel for being here. It has been a blast. Tomorrow on News One Now, Roland is back talking about the conclusion of the New York to D.C. March for Justice that is demanding change to our legal system. Be sure to go to newsone.com for more stories and updates. You can follow me on Twitter at Mo Ivory. Also, you can find the show on the News One Facebook page. Thank you and have a great day.
Have a great day.
Wherever you are, we are. Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.